What if the goal of political correctness is not, as some of my Facebook friends like to say, to, quote, protect little snowflakes from melting, but actually to change the way people think, including us? I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. First, I want to say thank you for being part of this project. Thank you for liking us and sharing our videos. You are an important part of this, and that's how we get to meet new people. And I just wanted to say thank you in advance for doing that. If you haven't already, click the like button and share it with your friends. We appreciate it. You may know Michael Knowles from his daily podcast. You may hear his voice from the car speakers as you listen to him on the radio. Or maybe you've heard him or your kids have heard him on campus in connection with Young America's Foundation. Here's what I like about him. And I'm going to tell you that. Hi, Michael. How you doing?
It's good to be here. Thanks for so much for having me.
Hey, here's what I like about you. You actually think about things. And then you make real live arguments that cause people to actually have to think about what they think. And that is so valuable in culture today. And I'm looking forward to this conversation for that reason. You got the book there. See, I had to make a fake copy on my big screen here. You've got the actual one. It just came out, what, 3 days ago, 4 days ago, something like that?
It came out a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And, but you may not have heard of it because we hit number one on the Publishers Weekly national bestseller list. So, you know, measuring the number of books sold, we hit number one. We're very grateful to all the readers.
Yeah.
So, of course, the New York Times had to completely snub us. So you may not have heard.
Oh, it's misinformation, man. We all know that. In the book, you brilliantly lay out the argument for something I've commented on and talked about for years, and it's simply this, that the fight over the words we say is really a fight over the thoughts that we think. Unpack that thought for us.
Well, in the early days of political correctness, or of our national awareness of political correctness, which started about 30 years ago, even though PC goes back, I argue, about 100 years, people had this idea that political correctness was just sort of a distraction. You know, why are we arguing over these semantic issues when we could be talking about important things like the economy or whatever? Now, what these people missed, I think, and it was mostly conservatives, but some leftists sort of took up this view, what they miss is that semantics means meaning. It means the meaning of words. And so when we argue about semantics, we're arguing about how we understand meaning in our culture, in our day-to-day life, in our whole political order. And it's very important because words carry whole premises. You know, if I call someone a bum or a tramp or a vagabond or a derelict, that will call to mind certain ideas. That will suggest he has some moral responsibility for what he's doing. That will suggest certain ways to deal with that problem. But if you refer to that same person as an unhoused victim of oppression or something like that, that will call to mind another idea. If you refer to an illegal alien as an illegal alien, then that person has no right to be in the country. If you refer to that person as a future undocumented American or some other
Or dreamer is the...
Or a dreamer, right, yeah. Right. Then that person obviously does have the right to be in the country. They're Americans, they just don't have documents yet or something like that. So the words are going to carry whole premises. And my contention in the book is that the manipulation of language is the most effective tool, the primary way that the left has transformed our culture. And I think conservatives have fallen for a big trap, and we've been utterly impotent in fighting against it for decades.
And we're going to get to that trap in just a bit here. First, I want to get you to define some terms for us. In your book, you say, to call something politically correct is to acknowledge that it is not correct, at least to the standard of reality. Unpack that thought for us.
So often you'll hear with the politically correct language what William Safire, the late conservative columnist, referred to as the adjectivally pre-modified lexical unit. And he's obviously making a joke about the way that PC language works. You'll hear instead of someone being called short, they'll be called vertically challenged, right? These sort of euphemisms that take an adjective or an adverb to modify a noun or an adjective. And so you've got, for instance, justice. Justice means getting what you deserve without favor. Then you have the leftist redefinition of a term like social justice. What does social justice mean? It means that you get what you do not deserve because you are favored. You'll hear a term like, there's racism, for instance, right? This is hatred or antagonism to someone on the basis of their race. And then you've got anti-racist, but that just means racist, right? It actually doesn't quite mean what it says it means. And you see this even with the term political correctness. So when we call something politically correct, The reason that we use this term politically before correct is to distinguish it from things that are just outright correct. And very often when we use political correctness, it's not a euphemism in the way that we all use euphemisms to be polite. We call, you know, an older woman a woman of a certain age. Well, that doesn't negate the meaning of an older woman. It just kind of softens it.
It will draw the same reaction, though.
And it will. That's true. Yeah. You've got to be careful.
Because everybody knows. I mean, we hear the term, but we still know somewhere in us that it actually means something else.
Right. Or even, you know, if you refer to a trans woman, this is a popular one right now, you're acknowledging that this person is not a woman. He's a man who thinks that he's a woman. But when you get to a term that's very popular now in academic and legal circles, and maybe you've heard it, the justice-involved person.
Yeah, that one bugs me. Yeah, San Francisco. San Francisco passed a rule on that, right?
Ordinance. I think so, yes. And you're seeing it crop up in multiple cities. When you hear justice-involved person, you think, oh, it must refer to a judge or maybe a police officer. No, it refers to a criminal who is, if he's involved in anything, he's involved in injustice. So PC uses these euphemisms not to soften things, but to invert reality, and I think they've done it pretty effectively.
Now, here's the core to the argument that you're making, and this is what you were hinting at just a few moments ago, and that is this. You go on to say that conservatives, by and large, have failed to properly counter political correctness because we don't understand what it's really all about. We start talking about free speech, and I have the right to say what I want, and you don't have a right not to be offended. But you say that that plays right into the goal of what they're trying to do. Explain that for me.
I think it does. I think it's well-meaning. I think people who call themselves free speech absolutists, I think their heart is in the right place, but I think they've fallen for a trap. And the trap is this. PC sets out to undo traditional standards. That's what it sets out for. I chronicle in my book many of the leftist theorists who developed this phenomenon, and that was what they were after, to upend society, to resettle standards on their own grounds. So, on the one hand, you've got the squishes. The squishes just go along with the new woke standard, and they use whatever jargon the left wants them to use. Obviously, they advance political correctness. But even the more stalwart conservatives, even the ones who say, I'm a free speech absolutist, you're not going to get me to go along with your new speech codes, very often they will abandon standards entirely. They will say, as you point out, say whatever you want, do whatever you want, there's no standards at all. They too are advancing political correctness because either way the traditional standards are abandoned, and because nature abhors a vacuum, the leftist woke standard is going to come in and take its place, as it largely has.
So what do we do? What is the proper response then?
There is a third option, but in order to pursue the third option, you've got to recognize that political correctness is not a battle between free speech on the one hand and censorship on the other. Free speech is a battle between competing sets of standards. I think you need to recognize, and we all do, I've fallen prey to this myself, that all societies have standards, all societies have taboos, all societies will impose limits on the things that you can say. Sure, political correctness limits what you're allowed to say. So does chivalry. So does every other standard in every other society. And so the left understands this very well. And I think they've used it to their advantage because they've recognized that the limits that inevitably will be imposed on speech can be transformed to their benefit. And so I think what conservatives need to do is offer not just these abstract procedural arguments about free speech or freedom of belief or whatever, but we need to make substantive arguments as well. We need to offer people a substantive moral vision of society, because the fact is, free speech in the abstract does not mean anything to people who have nothing to say.
Let's talk about liberty. You write that radicals have, and I'm quoting here, conflated licentiousness, the permission to do as one pleases, with liberty, which is the right to do as one ought, O-U-G-H-T. You add that the people who founded the nation considered that an essential distinction for us to understand this nation, which was founded in liberty. Unpack that thought for us.
I think this is the heart of the confusion, actually, between free speech or freedom of belief or whatever you want. In some ways today, people have more free speech than they used to, right? All those words that George Carlin said that we couldn't say on TV, now I think you might be obligated to say them on TV. They're so pervasive. Yeah. However, you're now no longer allowed to make perfectly ordinary observations that men are not women, or that America's a good place, or that white people are not evil, or whatever the new standards that are being imposed. And the issue here, I think, is that for our founding fathers, for Christians, for the pre-Christian philosophers, they all understood that liberty means tamping down your base passions and cultivating the higher virtues and bringing your appetites into accord with your rational will. And to bring that down to earth, what that means is that liberal education sought to make sense of your freedom so that you were a free citizen. When John Adams says that the Constitution's built for a moral and religious people, he's not just Bible thumping, far from it. He's just making this observation about liberty. Today, that has largely been supplanted by an understanding of liberty as licentiousness, something the founders really warned us against. And the licentious view of liberty is that liberty means doing whatever you want whenever you want to do it. So under that view, a heroin addict, for instance, is the freest person in the world. As long as he's got a couple bucks in his pocket, as long as he can score some drugs and shoot it into his veins, goodness gracious, isn't he free? Now, we all know that that guy isn't free. We know that guy is a slave to his appetites. But the left has really cleverly managed to do this. And they've told us that when you throw off shackles, the traditional social mores on drugs, on sex, on civility, on interpersonal relations, when you throw all of that away to pursue whatever base appetites you have, then you will truly be free. And I think looking around our society today, it would take an act of insanity to conclude that we are freer today than we were, say, 50 or 100 years ago. And it's because of that confusion. So if we want to return to the freedom of, or the liberty tradition in America, what we need to do is recognize that liberty has limits. And as a consequence of that, our speech regime is going to have limits too. And we need to impose just, wise, good limits on them and not the mad standards of the left.
And it strikes me that the key to this is, under the right to do as we ought, that is self-imposed. In other words, if most of culture accepts that as a basis for behavior and interaction with other people, then we only need a minimal amount of policing and government. But if you take liberty and define it as the freedom to do whatever you want, whenever you want, nobody can stop me, then you've got to have a lot of law enforcement and you've got to have a lot of government to keep us protected from each other.
Right, because if you cultivate true liberty to any significant degree, then you are going to rein yourself in. And I think what we need to recognize is that there will be order. We are not going to live in some anarchistic utopia. There will be order. The order can be imposed by you, the individual, by the family, by the local community, by the standards of society, or it can be imposed by the heavy hand of some police state, but it will be imposed. And so I prefer the idea that we can govern ourselves. But if you really don't do that, then you've lost the capacity for self-government. I mean, you've seen this argument break out on the right recently with a former conservative columnist who famously defended drag queen story hour as one of the blessings of liberty. And, you know, James Madison rolls over in his grave at the very thought of that. But to be charitable to his argument, what he's saying is that if we tell the left that perverts can't twerk for little kids at the library, why then they're going to tell us that we can't go to church on Sunday. And as a practical matter, they're already telling us we can't go to church on Sunday in many cases. But even at the broader point, if you really are saying that we cannot discern between a pervert jiggling for a kid and a pastor preaching the gospel, then what you are saying is that we do not have faculties of reason, we do not have a moral conscience, we can't discriminate between good and bad and right and wrong and true and false. And at that point, self-government really is not possible. And as you've seen this view become adopted on the left and even on the right, you've seen the growth of oligarchic, unaccountable forces in our government that are going to impose order on us, whether we like it or not.
Now, First Liberty Institute is an organization that exclusively pursues cases in court that deal with religious freedom. That's what we're about and what we do. So there are a few topics in your book that really caught my eye. Here's one. You make the case, citing Locke, that our notions of tolerance rely on Christianity. One cannot coherently demand the former while rejecting the latter. Now, you've dealt with that a little bit, but I want to hear a little more about that. Why is the foundation of faith essential to America's actual existence? We can't continue if we don't have some foundation to rely on.
Well, to quote a famous Christian writer, G.K. Chesterton, there is a thought that stops thought, and that is the only thought that ought to be stopped. And some people in reacting to my book have accused me of illiberalism or authoritarianism or whatever nonsense. You know, they call all of us fascists, I guess. I
mean, all the time.
We could sneeze the wrong way, they'll call us fascists. But I cite, as you mentioned, John Locke. In his letter concerning toleration, the father of liberalism says we want broad toleration, but you can't tolerate an idea that would undo the entire premise of toleration, which we get from Christianity. You see this with John Milton, too. John Milton in Areopagitica, most famous defense of free speech in the English language. He says we need broad toleration for freedom of speech, except among atheists and Catholics. I'm glad that we've gotten rid of the Catholic prohibition, because otherwise I would not be able to write my book. But I see the point that he's making. He's saying that there are these threats of religious war that would undermine the entire political order, and if you lose the entire political order, you lose free speech too. There necessarily are going to be limits to this. This is why it's an incoherent action to cite the First Amendment to burn the American flag, because you are torching the symbol of the entire country, which gives you your First Amendment, right, that protects your First Amendment, and you're citing your First Amendment to do that. That's incoherent. And so many people, and I know that you've seen this up close and personal, many people will cite the broad religious toleration in the history of the United States as some example of a firm separation between church and state, or the idea that America is a secular country. Nothing could be further from the truth. And they will cite this to such a bizarre degree that now, when you're in school, you can teach Ibram Kendi. You can teach radical racial theories, radical sexual theories. You can teach Mein Kampf, for goodness sakes. The only book you can't teach is the Bible. You can have all sorts of religious rituals to Earth Day or to Black Lives Matter or the Pride Month. But the one religious ritual you can't have is a simple prayer to God. And it seems to me that we've just completely inverted the society. And as a result, by the way, it's no surprise that our Christian notions of toleration and free speech that we have had in our country and enjoyed for a long time are collapsing as a result.
And you devoted, and I was going through the book, and then I'm like, there's a whole chapter, speaking of things that you can't do in public school, there's a whole chapter on the war on Christmas. Even my friends are sick of the war on Christmas, but you double down. You go all the way back to the historical roots of it and explain why that is emblematic of all this that we're talking about right here.
I do double down on it because I think the left makes an incoherent argument on the war on Christmas. They say on the one hand it's completely contrived and ridiculous and, it doesn't exist at all. And also it's not a big deal and get over it.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Well, hold on a second. Dr. Fauci recently did this on the issue of gain of function research. He said, we are not funding gain of function research. And even if we are, it's totally fine. You say, well, hold on, which argument are you making?
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of a line from Cardinal Manning, who famously said that all human conflict ultimately is theological. St. Andrew Breitbart says politics is downstream of culture. Well, culture is downstream of religion. The cult and culture come from the same root word. So what a culture worships is going to define that culture. And so it's no surprise. I completely understand why the secular left is trying to root out religious expressions of Christmas in the public. These days, they're even trying to root out secular expressions of Christmas. So I outline in painstaking detail all of the concrete actions that they undertook that they cannot deny in good faith. But I also see why they're doing it, because every culture is going to have some kind of religious basis. We're going to have, every state in history has had some kind of religious idea. I know it's fashionable these days to say that you cannot legislate morality, but it's a preposterous slogan. All laws legislate morality. You could be talking about the death penalty, or you could be talking about parking tickets. You are making arguments that refer to the moral order, and you're referring to these objective things that are outside just of the civil law to make your point. So, yes, we are going to have some kind of views. I mean, the country is predicated on the idea that there are self-evident truths, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. That's a religious premise. And so as the left seeks to transform the religious underpinning of society, be it through an outward example like the war on Christmas, or be it through subtler examples through the law and our educational systems, as you transform that foundation, so too you will transform the country.
Now, the people that are sharing in this conversation with us right now, watching online, because all we do is religious liberty, that's our focus. It's something that they're interested in. It's something they think about a lot. What do each of us need to do to keep our thoughts, our thinking process clear of the fog of political correctness that you've outlined here?
So one has to be very careful of every single word. I know now there's a question of, do we refer to Bruce Jenner? Do we call him Bruce at all? Do we call him Caitlyn? Do we call him her? Do we call him? And I know a lot of people, like you mentioned, your friends and my friends, who say, oh, who cares about the war on Christmas? Just give it up. Or more recently, who cares about the pronouns? I'll call him whatever he wants to be called. The left cares. The left cares quite a lot, and that's why they're investing a lot of time and energy and money into getting you to refer to a man as she and her, because they know that words carry whole premises. And if they can get you to deny and even invert the fundamental distinction in human nature, despite what you know from your own lying eyes, then they can get you to say anything. And this is where comparisons to George Orwell's 1984 or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World come in. Yeah. If the establishment can get you to deny reality in the most overt way, they can really control you in any way you want. So I think a key here is, as we talk about religious liberty, as we talk about tolerance, as we talk about free speech, all things that we really like, we need to recognize that you should not be so open-minded that your brain falls out, to use a line from William F. Buckley Jr., who was actually quoting a liberal president of Yale University. He said, skepticism has utility only when it leads to conviction. He had a debate once with Leo Chern on his show Firing Line, and Chern was shocked that Buckley didn't want a totally open society. Don't forget, the name of George Soros' very left-wing foundation, it's the Open Society Foundation. Right. Buckley said, I actually want the society to be considerably more closed. He called himself an epistemological optimist, by which he said, I think we can know things, and I think certain things are going to be settled. And if we are to exist at all in a society, we need to agree on certain things. We need to agree on some basic beliefs. We need to agree on basically how we're going to get along together. And most importantly, we need to agree on our language, because otherwise we can't speak to one another. As old Uncle Aristotle says, freedom of speech, or rather speech itself, is what makes man the political animal. It's what distinguishes us from the brutes who just grunt and club each other and impose their own interest. Increasingly, this is what our political system looks like, but we can't have that. We need to be able to have the courage, which is a virtue and the prerequisite for the other virtues, to say that some things are true and others false, some good, others bad, some right, and others wrong. And we have to ditch this crazy skepticism that tells us that we don't know and drag queen story hour is just the same as going to church on Sunday. We need to have the courage of our convictions to state the truth plainly to our countrymen.
Now, many people will hear that, and we'll close out with this, and some will want to go to harsher language to try to make the point that you're making. They'll want to call people names and try to return in kind the things that are being thrown at us. But what I'm hearing from you is that what's really necessary is clarity of speech and thinking, and then action. I mean, inaction is also a decision. So we need to think clearly, we need to speak clearly, and we need to act affirmatively.
You know, I worked on a political campaign when I was a wee lad, and I got some great advice on that campaign, on the very point you're mentioning. Never wrestle with a pig, because you'll both get dirty and the pig will like it. You're not going to beat the left at this game of throwing logic out the window and using invective and imposing your will. The left is much better at that. What we have on our side is logic, clarity, and reality, the idea that reality will reassert itself in the end. It doesn't matter what some crazy leftist says. A man is a man and a woman is a woman, and there are many truths beyond that. And so I think that one can be courageous, one can be clear, one can be strong without being petty and childish and mean. We have a bit of a harder job before us, but yeah. But I do think we have an advantage, which is namely reality.
Yeah, very good. I'm going to let you go. Anything else you want to share before I let you move on out of here?
Not at all. I've so enjoyed the conversation, and I'm always honored when someone actually has read the book. So often, one will do an interview, and you can tell the interviewer's never read a word of the book, so I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your listeners for reading as well.
A lot of great thoughts there for us to ponder, a lot of good insights. I really appreciate you writing the book and also sharing with us today. Hey, We want to share with you, those of you who are watching, something that will make it easier for you to follow us here at First Liberty Live. We have a brand new app that you can download, and it's the easiest way to connect with the programming that we do. You can either play it as a video right there on your phone or device, or you can cast it to your TV and share it with your friends, or you can just listen to the audio part and maybe listen to it as a podcast in your car or elsewhere if you choose to, if that's easier for you. Just go to, it's both for the iPhone and the droids and all that, just look for First Liberty Live, and you'll recognize the logo and download the app. It will notify you when new episodes are released so that you can keep track of everything we do. We will see you next time right here on First Liberty Live.